Well, I met this gentleman via Zoom last February on the Late Late Show over on Friday nights, but I'm delighted to be talking to him again. Dave Grohl is one of the most affable men in rock and roll, no doubt about that. And he has written about his ongoing career from underground punk rock drummer to stadium busting frontman with his band, the Foo Fighters. He's got such a story to tell, and he always tells it in a delightful way. Dave Grohl, welcome to the program. Nice to talk to you again.
Thank you very much. It's good to talk to you.
Every time I talk to you, it's our second time. But when I get to speak to you, I think two things. And one is your very profound connection to this country. And we spoke before about you ringing your mother the morning you woke up in Cork in 1991 when you were on your first tour in Nirvana. But this time, Ireland featuring again in the book. But you were at a very different crossroads in your life when you saw a young man hitchhiking in Dingle.
Yeah, that's true. I mean, yes, it was after Nirvana ended. I wasn't entirely sure what I was going to do. I didn't necessarily want to play music. And I was young. I think I was 25 years old. Mm. And I'd been to Ireland before and made my way around the Ring of Kerry once before. And so I rented a car and wound up driving. I flew over and I just started driving around, you know, just sort of trying to figure out what to do with the rest of my life. And as I was coming around this country road, I saw a hitchhiker. And I thought, you know, he was young and it was sort of raining. And I thought, well, maybe I'll pick him up. And as I got closer, I noticed that he had a Kurt Cobain T-shirt on. And that was the moment where I realized, you know, I need to go home and figure this out. And that's when I started the Foo Fighters.
When you have a sort of cathartic moment like that in your life at such a young age, I often wonder, like, how equipped are you emotionally or mentally to handle those decisions and those life experiences? Looking back now as a dad and as an accomplished artist, you've seen such a callow youth.
Well, you know, I think that when you come to those crossroads in life, no matter how old you are, you make the decision and you have to, you know, you have to live with the consequence of that decision. And so that's one of the most challenging things about navigating life is, you know, you make the decision and you cross your fingers and hope that you made the best one. Sometimes you don't, you know. And for me, when Nirvana became popular, I think I was 21 or 22 years old.
Yeah.
And I don't know if anyone's emotionally, you know, qualified or capable to navigate that kind of experience at any age. But, you know, when you're young, you just kind of have to steer the wheel. You just kind of keep going in a forward direction.
But when you go back another, say, decade in your life, when you're 16, and you talk about touring the US and Europe and you know, your mother waving you off and living on $7 a day. And do you ever look back at those times in the innocence of it, not being well known, and think, sometimes I enjoyed that innocence more than I enjoyed the big stuff?
Oh, no, the big stuff's much better.
Okay, so no Rosebud for you then.
No, it's much better now. You know, I'm walking around a hotel suite talking to someone on a radio station. I much prefer this.
Yeah.
I think the good thing about those early years was that it really does sort of like lay this foundation.
Mm.
And so you use it as to keep this perspective on everything for the rest of your life. Like, I wouldn't be as appreciative as I am now without those experiences. And of course, you know, I mean, yes, it was great. I left school. I jumped in a van with some people. We drove around and slept on floors and played rock and roll every night. Mm. It was beautiful. It was great. But I did learn to survive back then on almost nothing. So now every time I walk into a backstage and I see that, oh, there's some free beer in that bucket. Like, I still to this day,
yeah.
I look at it and I think, okay, all right, this is fine. This is good.
Yeah. That's the point I think I was trying to make quite badly, was that you weren't born into a life of buckets full of free beer. You had to earn them.
No. There was no free beer until about 1991. Then it was everywhere.
I love just reminding people who didn't see that the last time you joined us on the TV show was you're chatting about your mother and how you got to Ireland. You looked around and suddenly saw your mother everywhere. Because you realized the profound nature of the Irish gene in your family.
Oh, yeah. I mean, you know, I knew that we had Irish heritage,
sure,
in our family, but I'd never been. So the first time I came, I woke up, I walked outside, and everyone looked like my mother. I ran back to the phone and I called her. I'm like, Mom, everybody looks exactly like you here.
Yeah. Actually, I'll come back to the book in a moment, Dave, but when we spoke the last time, your mother was very actively talking about teaching and with the Biden administration. And now that that's bedded in a little, how is she doing? And is she still flying that flag?
Yeah, she's well. I mean, listen, she was a public school teacher her entire life. 35 years she taught public school. And I think, you know, in order to become a teacher, you have to have a very specific disposition. Most teachers are, you know, they're altruistic and they're caring and they're giving. They devote their lives to other people. And she is that way. She's still that way. I mean, I talk to her every day. She's my best friend. And so she's doing well. I think that, you know, it's still a challenge to try to bring things back to where they were before, which I don't know if that's entirely possible, but to get them to a place where kids, you know, can feel comfortable in a group learning environment again. But, you know, that's what teachers do. Yes. They figure out how to get the kids to the next step. And if that takes adapting and change, they'll figure it out. Because they're the smart ones, you know. Oh. It's not us. They're the smart ones.
When you say they, the kids or the teachers?
The teachers.
Yeah. Sometimes I'm led by the next generation, but equally I'm in awe of the teachers in society.
Oh, they're amazing people. And I was raised in a community of them, and I have nothing but respect for them all.
You know, you used to go to jazz clubs with your mother. And
I did, yeah.
What I'm so intrigued about you is how democratic you are about the music that inspired you and that you continue to love. So you don't say, oh, you know, you don't have to name check the quote unquote cool music down through the years. You're happy to say that it was this, that, and the other. You know, where some people say you've got to say the Rolling Stones, not say the Beatles. You always go, no, the Beatles guy or Neil Diamond or whatever it might be. Can you talk to me about that, about the lack of snobbery in your approach to music?
Well, I still feel the same as I did when I was a young boy in my bedroom learning how to play guitar. So back then I knew nothing about cool. I didn't know anything about what to listen to or what not to listen to. I just took everything in. And I mean, it could be like doo-wop Manhattan Transfer music or a show tune or Aerosmith or AC/DC. Like, to me, music was just this beautiful puzzle or this mystery that I was trying to figure out. It didn't matter what type or what genre of music. But I really think that, you know, I think it's important for people to remember that there should be no guilty pleasure. Yeah. There should just be pleasure. And whether it's Gangnam Style or Let It Be, who cares? Like, it's music. And if you dig it, then you should dig it and be okay with that. So, yeah, I mean, a long time ago, my mother, she always gave great advice. And she said, I asked her about peer pressure when she was young. Yeah. And she said, you know, she said, I never compared myself to other people. She said, I always just felt like my own person. I never compared myself to anyone else. And I thought that was, it's one of my favorite little nuggets of wisdom that she's given me. So I've never really felt any pressure to be cool. And to be honest, I've never felt cool. I've always felt like a nerd, you know, I still do. So I can feel okay with loving the new pop artist that just came out. I'm into it. It's okay.
Isn't it? You're in a very safe harbor here. I can tell you with those feelings, because it is a very, very lovely place to arrive at when you embrace the nerdism and say, this is what and who I am, and I can't fight it anymore.
Exactly. Yeah. Like, it feels good to be able to say that.
I would have thought so. When you look at, like, punk music got you on the road when you were young, and that's why I think some people go, God, but he must be that must be his bailiwick, and that's where he should be. But why was it that particular genre of music, let's say, that kind of brought you into the big time, in a manner of speaking?
Well, you know, one of the things I loved the most about the underground punk rock scene was the independence of it. You know, when I was young, in my bedroom, I had posters on the wall that had Zeppelin posters and Beatles posters and Kiss posters and things like that. And so I thought that was, you know, I thought that was rock and roll. I thought rock and roll was like lasers and dragons and explosions. And it didn't seem it didn't seem attainable to me. It just seemed like this fantasy world. And then the first time I ever saw a band play was a punk rock band in a small club in Chicago. And I mean, they had three amplifiers, one microphone, there were maybe two lights on the stage, and they knew four chords. And that, to me, the first time I saw a live band perform, it was so simple and so raw and so pure. And I realized, oh my, I can do this. Like, I know those four chords. I have some friends. We could put together a band. We could find a small club. We can do it. And there was something about the independence of it, where everyone was making records on their own, and they'd start their own record company, and they'd make their own albums and write their own songs. And that to me, I was so attracted to the idea that I could do it as well. And so that's why it was so influential to me. Of course, the music, it was like the music was raw. There was energy. There was this like excitement to it. But the thing that I loved the most was that I could do it too. And so that's really kind of what began. It began, you know, me starting the Foo Fighters or me touring the world, things like that. Yeah. It all started with the idea that I could do it.
And boy, did you do it in style, Nirvana, Foo Fighters, and on it goes. And yet, in the middle of it all, Dave, you have this, I got this sense about you, and if I may be wrong, but that you're still a fan. You're a fan of, you know, you talk about the posters in your bedroom as a kid. The next thing you know, you've got Paul McCartney knocking on your front door when your child is born, and you're thinking, you know, is this my new normal? I mean, it's bonkers.
It's never normal. I mean, that's one of the things about the book. When I started writing the book, you know, the book is basically written from the perspective of someone who's having an out-of-body experience all the time. Like, I'm watching this happen to someone else. Yeah. It's hard to believe that it's happening to me. So, I mean, you know, I've had the pleasure and the honor to meet some of my great heroes. And when I do, you know, I try to be present and I try to just think of us all as human beings. But no, it's like, it's Paul McCartney. It's Ringo Starr. Yeah. It's Mick Jagger. Yeah. It's like, it's these people that really shape my life. And it never feels normal, but it feels okay.
What do you do when you're at the White House and the president is giving McCartney an award and you're told, yeah, listen, play the drums there, and then they add another request on top of it? I mean, do you freak out, or how do you roll with that?
Well, you know, it's funny because when I was young, we would go to these sort of like political protest concerts on the Mall in Washington, D.C. I grew up outside of Washington, D.C., and so they would have these concerts on the 4th of July with punk rock bands, like real sort of like punk rock protest concerts. And there was the Rock Against Reagan concert. That was a big one. They had it every year. And it was like the conservative administration. And there's all these punks down there like screaming at the president. And then, you know, years later, now I'm at the White House playing on the South Lawn in Obama's first year as president. And all I could think was like, I made it over the fence.
Yeah.
You know,
yeah,
I used to be over there, and now I made it over the fence, and so did President Obama. Like, we made it over the fence, and here we are. So now, you know, it's kind of like this slow change of getting your foot in the door. And whenever, you know, when you go to the White House and you're invited to one of those functions, you know, there's a certain level of it feels surreal in a way, but you definitely feel honored to be there, because it's, you know, it's as a Washington D.C. boy, my hometown, to make my way over that fence and share an experience with the president is, you know, it's an honor. I enjoy doing it.
Would you describe fatherhood, three daughters, as your greatest achievement, or am I putting words in your mouth?
No question. Yes, my daughters are the love of my life. They're all brilliant people. They're an adventure in themselves. Like, every morning I wake up and I think, oh God, what's going to happen today? But I love watching them become the people that they're becoming. And it's great. I mean, it's the only thing I like to do other than play music is to be a dad. That's basically it. That's all I do.
Well, hear to that. Our time has come to an end, sadly, but thank you so much for your time today, Dave Grohl. It's been lovely to talk to you again, and we'll see you soon in Ireland, hopefully. Take care.
All right. We'll see you soon. Thank you.
Thank you so much. Dave Grohl is the obviously the singer, the artist, and the writer of the storyteller Tales of Life and Music. And we'd urge you to buy that from your local bookshop if you can. And just one of the good guys. Simple as that. Lovely to talk to him this morning. The text number is always 51551.